darkest stone way over in the corner weeping all alone. Won't say anybody, don't you be no square. You can't find a party, use a one.
Oh, you know that song well. I don't care how old you are, how young you are, Elvis Presley, the king of rock and roll. There will never be another Elvis Presley, but it's coming pretty close right now, and that's if you go see Heartbreak Hotel over at the Water Tower Place, the Broadway Playhouse, where that show is currently running. And I'll tell you, if you're into Elvis music and stuff, this is the story you've been wanting to hear, and you've been wanting to hear it probably since you saw Million Dollar Quartet. Joining me is the man playing Elvis himself, Eddie Clendenning, who actually originated the role in Heartbreak Hotel when it opened up in May, and in Maine, I should say, the state of Maine, and originating in here. But you know what? You may remember him from Million Dollar Quartet. Actually, Eddie, I interviewed you back during that time, way back when. And of course, he went to Broadway with this show as well. Anyway, he's the closest thing you're ever going to get to Elvis. Eddie Clendenning, welcome to the podcast.
How you doing? Thanks for having me on.
I'm doing well. You know, I wanted to ask you stuff that like other people don't ask you, but I'm going to start with something that might be typical, which is
sure. Hit me with it.
Were you always an Elvis fan? And because this seems to consume your career over the last few years, is it something that you always wanted to live, or is it something now you have grown to appreciate?
So I definitely have always loved old music. Since I was even too young to really kind of identify what that was, but it, for me, the thing that really first grabbed me was a lot of the old country blues artists.
Sure.
And then I kind of found my way through that into the 50s rock and roll stuff, and I was like, oh wait, there's this whole wave of these like goofy white kids who were also into this stuff, and then were trying to recreate it in some sort of way. And that's when I sort of started identifying. That movie La Bamba came out.
Yeah, Lou Diamond Phillips.
I remember someone gave me, as a little kid, a cassette tape of that. And then like a Hits of the 50s cassette. And that had Carl Perkins and Eddie Cochran and Gene Vincent, Jerry Lee Lewis. So I had all that stuff in my head. And then Elvis was just kind of, he just existed. You know, it's kind of hard to be in the world and not encounter him in some way.
Sure.
But he was like the jumpsuit guy, you know? So I didn't really make the connection until a few years down the road with a movie called This Is Elvis. And they had some of those like First Son recordings of that. And I remember the first time I heard like That's All Right, Mama, and even the demo of My Happiness that he first cut at Sun Records. And it was really like one of those moments of like chills of like, wow, this is something special.
Did you, as you were growing up, I mean, because look, your look now is an Elvis look. You've got that look. Is that also part of who you are? Would people kind of, you know, take you for Elvis anyway if you weren't doing this role, or have you again adjusted to this role, this persona that you play now?
Yeah, that's the funny thing. I've always gotten that, you know, in school. I got, you know, either picked on or praised for, you know, looking like Elvis or whatever. But actually, I've always had this, like, pompadour haircut. But it started out with me just, my grandfather was, like, my biggest hero as a kid. And he was just this sort of smooth old Italian guy with this, you know, bro-creamed back, head of black hair.
Yeah.
I just wanted to be so much like him. And then it just sort of naturally, when I started getting into all the rockabilly stuff, I was like, well, I've already got that happening. I don't have to change my hairstyle at all.
Where'd you grow up?
Denver, Colorado.
So you weren't an L.A. guy, you weren't a, you know, Jersey guy, like some of those, whatever. You grew up in Denver, so I'm sure Elvis got out there as well. So Million Dollar Quartet, which, of course, played forever and a day, both at the Apollo Theater in Chicago, where I saw it a few times, and, of course, on Broadway, where, my God, huge hits. And, again, our mutual friend Levi Christ won a Tony playing Jerry Lee Lewis. Man, you guys were all so great. Well, do you have a sense in just all the work you've done with Floyd Moutroux, who wrote Heartbreak Hotel? He also wrote Million Dollar Quartet. Was it the response to Million Dollar Quartet, which, of course, I should invite you to remind people what that was, the magic evening of four great stars. What led, do you think, Floyd to say, you know what, Elvis needs his own moment?
So actually how this all came about was Floyd is sort of like a, he's a character. I don't know if you've had a chance to cross his path, but he's a he's like a kind of like the he would be like the madman in the lab coat or whatever, you know. He wrote just like a massive script, just this huge long thing. And I don't know what his plan for it was, but that someone took that cut it into three pieces, and the middle piece was what became Million Dollar Quartet. And so he still had these two other bookends of that. And one of those was sort of the Elvis-focused version, which, getting back to what you said, Million Dollar Quartet is the true story about Elvis, Jerry Lee Lewis, Johnny Cash, and Carl Perkins. In 1956, all ended up hanging out at Sun Records in Memphis after a Carl Perkins recording session and having a little jam session, and they rolled tape on it so you can go hear these guys playing music together, and it, you know, it's a bunch of gospel and country songs and things that they like to
it's
listen
amazing.
To, and then just having fun. That was sort of the middle piece, but he had this Elvis-centric front portion, and they said, you know, this could be its own thing. Let's work on it and turn it into something. So just because of my work with Million Dollar Quartet and having known Floyd, he called me when he first started to get to work on it, and I figured, why not?
Yeah. You know, and of course, that raises a few questions. Well, I'll go to that the question that triggers in my mind from that comment, which is, you know, there are some people, look, that, you know, get very famous from playing certain iconic roles. Some embrace it, and some
sure.
never want to talk about it. You're in the middle of it right now in your career, but do you get a sense that Elvis is something you'll always be proud of and always continue to talk about, or do you kind of think the day might come one day when you look back and say, hey, those were the playing Elvis days. I'm not. Eddie Clendenning's not there anymore.
Well, I mean, at some point I'm going to be too old. You know, I mean, I'm already pushing the limits here. But I love Elvis. I love his music. I love his contribution to popular culture. I love the sort of weirdo that he was. It's all very interesting to me. I have a fun time playing it. And this particular job affords me all the free time that I need and also opportunities to pursue my own music, to get that in front of people, to perform my own stuff for people, you know. So it's not always ideal. Sometimes when you get lumped in to the Elvis impersonator world, I think very unfairly for a lot of people, you get written off as any sort of like actual artist or musician. But I started out playing my own music, and you know, I'll finish playing my own music. That's always the most fulfilling for me. But in the meantime, you know, I get to perform and put smiles on people's faces and get paid and get health insurance, and I have no resentment towards that at all.
Yeah, no, you got to be. And by the way, we should mention, you've got some albums out there. Eddie Clendenning mm-hmm. is Walking and Crying. Eddie Clendenning is Knocking at Your Heart. Eddie Clendenning is The Rage of the Teenage. There seems to be kind of a part of a series going on there.
Yeah, that actually comes from, like, the old movie posters of, you know, like, you know, Gary Cooper is, you know, so-and-so, or, you know, and they have
right.
these big, massive...
You are an old soul, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. All that sort of stuff always resonated with me. So that was, it kind of all started out as a joke, and just kind of ended up being a recurring theme. But yeah, I've got my own stuff. I got a fourth album that me and Matt Codina, who's also in the show with me, plays Scotty Moore. We worked on here in Chicago, actually, that we... Now that we're back in town, plan to finish and release at some point. And we've got two more projects that we're kind of cooking up right now. So, yeah, there's a
right.
lot of...
And I should add, so people that want to get your obviously, we can go to Amazon or maybe CD Baby. Where's a good place to check you out in your albums while we're talking about it?
Yeah, all those online outlets are the best right now. My website is sort of comically non-existent. It's always been a mess. All the records, backlog of my stuff that I had available for sale all recently met a terrible end in a basement flood at my dad's house with some asbestos. And so I have no more back catalog of any of my stuff. I have to repress everything. But there is things online, yeah, CD Baby, Spotify, iTunes, you know, all the online retailers have.
Well, it's great stuff, and I listen to some. I have subscribed to some of those, like Spotify, whatever. So I love your stuff. Let's get back to talk about Heartbreak Hotel, or we'll get yelled at.
Absolutely.
Which is, here's the thing, and you started to make the comment about, and I'm so glad you did, the Elvis impersonators kind of a thing. You know, I don't know that you, you know, I wrote a review of the show and they used a piece of it for the ad, but they didn't use the piece I want to tell you about, which is I talk about your portrayal and I talk about the fact that, yes, there are impersonators out there. I don't get the sense that that is what you are doing. And in fact, what I wrote in my review was my sense of what you're doing is if I had really known Elvis or you had really known Elvis, it's as though you really personify what the real guy was like. What really amazed me was how human you make him. You know, when people see Elvis, you see an impersonator. He's this larger-than-life figure that you don't even think you can connect with. I watched you on stage, and I thought, I could have a drink with that guy.
Well, thank you. That is my ultimate goal with Million Dollar Quartet and with Heartbreak Hotel.
That means you buy me a drink, right?
Absolutely, anytime.
Okay.
That's one of my favorite pastimes. But,
I love it. But anyway, go ahead. I mean, talk about that.
We have the luxury of knowing Elvis after he became what he is now, which is almost this sort of Zeus-like, you know, thing that the marketing machine has built him into. And, you know, he's a... And the impersonators do a version of that, which it's its own type of entertainment. This is the story about how he became that thing.
Yeah.
And also sort of a lot of the pitfalls and trappings that come with that process. So if I just came out doing karate and, you know, talking like Johnny Bravo or whatever, you'd get lost in the cartooniness of that as opposed to actually trying to make you care about a human being who was dealing with some consequences and some things that there necessarily wasn't a roadmap for at that time. So that I appreciate that you brought that up because
well,
that is something that's been important to me from the beginning.
And of course, when we watch some of the characters like Matt McKenzie playing Sam Phillips and especially Jerry Kernan, who's Colonel Tom Parker. Now they and especially Jerry does play Colonel Tom Parker the way I imagine Parker really was. I mean, he kind of you know wanted to control Elvis's career and all of that. But once again. It's so fascinating for me to watch your character because we all live in Elvis in the today and we look back on it from the days of today. I watch your interaction with the characters, Tom Parker, Sam Phillips, and you are a guy, Elvis was a guy, who wanted to be shaped. He had a dream. He wanted to make it. He had his girlfriend. But there was never a sense that as you portray Elvis that this is the guy that said, I'm taking James Dean out and I'm taking over. Not in those early days.
No. And I don't know that he was ever that way. There's those guys, and I think even Michael Jackson was kind of this way, where there's always this sort of a childlike sort of innocence, even as they become adults, in the way that they sort of ingest the world. And you know, Elvis was the hugest thing in the world, but I think from reading about him and talking to people who knew him, he was always just swallowing everything he could and so in awe of other performers. And you watch like Girls, Girls, Girls when he's on stage, he's doing Jackie Wilson.
Yeah.
100%, you know, he would see these people and he would find things that he loved about them or that stuck out to him. And he would ingest that and then make it his own thing. He never stopped learning. He never stopped watching and observing. And I think that makes the best artist, but also keeping some like a sort of innocence about it and not ever getting, I don't know a better way to say this, but like too far up your own cornhole there, you know, with like, you know.
It's up your own image
yeah,
anyway.
He just, I don't know if I'm articulating my point very well, but that's something I've always liked about him is that he never stopped kind of what made him so great in the beginning was he had all these things that he took from different aspects of popular culture and like threw them all into one blender and then outpoured this Elvis thing. And that even though he got huge and then became the thing that everyone else wanted to be, he never stopped, you know, ingesting all of those things and then putting them out into the world in his way.
Of course, you've been playing this role for a while now in between Million Dollar Quartet and Heartbreak Hotel. And I'm just curious, have you ever in the time, you know, Elvis's first girlfriend, Dixie Locke, played in the show by Aaron Burnaston. She's still around. I mean, she's alive. Have anybody from Elvis's real life in all the time you've been playing and whatever, have anybody come backstage or said, hey, wait a minute, I'm so-and-so. I'm Dixie. Have you ever met these guys?
Well, actually, before I had ever done any of this stuff, I had the opportunity to play with Scotty Moore and DJ Fontana, who's a guitar player and drummer from the original lineup, and had a good chance to hang and talk with them. And I've met, you know, various members of the Entourage. Everybody has an Elvis story, so they all want to tell you their story about the time they met him or whatever. Even my dad has a story about Elvis. But
did your dad meet him, or he just went and saw him one time?
He did, sort of accidentally, in an alley on his way to a funeral, which he said Elvis was trying to go into a funeral in a very incognito, in a sequin, like, you know, silvery suit.
Your typical incognito sequin suit. Yeah, I get it.
Yeah, exactly. So no one's going to notice you, you know, on the back of a church in your shiny suit. But, yeah, so everybody's got their Elvis story. And so I've heard a million of them, but I've met a few. I haven't met Dixie Locke. I did see there's a new movie coming out called The King. And Ethan Hawke actually goes and picks her up in Elvis's Rolls Royce and takes her to a prom. And they dance, and that was kind of a cool thing.
Yeah,
but we're not here to advertise that movie, are we? We're here to advertise.
No, but people, you know what? Here's the thing:
she is around.
If you see Million Dollar Quartet and you see Heartbreak Hotel, you kind of get into this stuff, and you want to know more. I mean, I'll be honest; I know a lot about Elvis, but you know, I didn't really know too much about Dixie. So that's what I'm saying: Heartbreak Hotel for the, you know, maybe the average Elvis fan or somebody who wants to know more whets your appetite in wanting to learn more. By the way, the night I was there, it was one of those second opening nights, I had several Elvises sitting down the row from me, and you noticed them. You called them out, actually, at the end of the show from the state. You get that every night? You got Elvis Libabees in the audience?
It's funny that I can usually see the Elvis guys right away when the lights come up because of the, like, jet black hair. And some of them will come in wearing the gold glasses, you know. And in my experience with these shows, it goes one of two ways. Either they're waiting after the show to talk to me and tell me about what they do and how much they like the show, or they hate it and they go storming out and I never hear from them. So it's I don't know what the difference is.
I think you know what it might be. The answer, Eddie, might literally be the power of the performance you are giving. Maybe, I have no idea, I'm not an Elvis guy, I mean Elvis impersonator, but maybe the folks who come dressed as Elvis and are living their life as Elvis, and by the ones next to me the night I was there, one was an older Elvis guy and the other one was fairly young, and
they're a father and son. They're pals of mine.
My point is
Chicago guys, and they're great. The son actually also does an excellent Johnny Cash, but anyway,
fabulous. Well, I was just gonna say, I think if people are living the Elvis image, the later Elvis, the Vegas Elvis, maybe if they're not happy, it's because they're getting this realistic portrayal. Maybe they don't want to see Elvis as the human being he actually was, which is the way we get him from you, which is exactly what I appreciated.
They're, having met thousands and thousands of Elvis fans at this point, everyone has their own very specific version of who Elvis was for them. And a lot of them don't like the human side or don't want to talk about that. They like keeping him in this place, and that's totally fine. For me, the quirks, the weirdness, the things that make a person a human are what makes Elvis endlessly interesting to me, and that's the stuff that I like to lean into. And that isn't for everybody, and I totally get that.
And you're open to all of it, and I know you're as nice as you can be to all the fans who come back, regardless of whether they, you know,
I love all the Elvis.
Whether they love the real the Elvis that they think he was, or the Elvis that you give us, which I think is more of the realistic Elvis. Hey, the show is scheduled to run through September 30th, but you know, listen, Million Dollar Quartet, you know, ran a lot longer than it was supposed to close. I don't know. Have you heard anything? What are you thinking?
Well, the response has been good. I'm all for being employed. I know they're always talking about what the plan is for the future of the show. If I imagine if Chicago wants to keep us around, I certainly wouldn't have a problem with staying. I love it here. This is a city for music. So if I'm going to be in a show about music, then I can't think of a place I would rather do it than Chicago. So hopefully we'll be here for a while.
And I love the fact that you are here. And by the way, you know, the DJ who kind of plays throughout this show, the character is Dewey Phillips. I'm sure you know this, but you saw the musical Memphis, right?
Yeah.
You know that's based on him. That's based on
Absolutely.
Dewey Phillips. So it's interesting to sort of see how Colt plays that role and then how it was, you know, played by Chad over on Broadway. Anyway, that's a side topic. But he was, you know, great DJ to have moderate this as it goes through. Well, September 30th is the only guarantee I can give my listeners out there, because after that, even Eddie doesn't know. So no promises. If you're going to see Heartbreak Hotel, and you should, to see this wonderfully realistic I think, portrayal of Elvis Presley, you want to see Eddie Clendenning before September 30th at the Broadway Playhouse at Water Tower Place. It's at 175 East Chestnut. So actually, Eddie, probably before you go into the theater, you run up to Garrett's and get some caramel corn or something on the 7th floor, right? You might as well.
Absolutely. Well, see, for me, Chicago, it's always about the food. So if it's not Garrett's, it's I'm heading over to Lazo's on the Brown Line to fill up on tacos. I'm all over the city.
I got some places to send you to, so we'll have to talk about that. You can get tickets at BroadwayInChicago.com. Don't miss it. This is just it's such an intimate here. The Broadway Playhouse. It's where I tape. I do a Broadway backstage show, and we tape it in that space. And I can tell you, I've been on that stage where you stand, and it's just such a great connection to the audience who's there, and you make that connection every night.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Check it out. Eddie Clendenning, you're wonderful. Thank you for all the time you spent with me on a day that you could be preparing and working and rehearsing and doing the show, which you'll be doing a little bit later on. Thank you so much for this. If you
Anytime.
Don't mind,
thanks for having me.
I want to go out. I'm not going to make you sing, but I'm going to go out hearing you sing. We're going to close this out with Shake, Rattle, and Roll. You do that so well. Hey, you break a leg tonight and every other night you do this show through September 30th at the Broadway Playhouse. Thank you, Eddie. Talk to you soon.
Cheers. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Well, get out of that bed, wash your face and hands. Take it out of that bed, wash your face and hands. Honking in that kitchen makes noise with your pots and pans. Now I believe you was so you the devil in my line up. I believe you was so you the devil in my line up. Bringing the heart around what the best of my money go.
All right, well, we're going to shift gears. Elvis has left the building, so to speak, and let's talk to who's entered the building, and that is a man who knows politics so well as a political strategist, as an attorney, and then there's so much stuff going on around now tied to both politics and the law that I had to pull this apart, so I reached out to my good friend Richard Gordon, and I said, please join me. He said, yes, he is with me once again. Richard, welcome back to the podcast.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure being here. I'm not as exciting as Elvis, nor do I sing as well, but I'm delighted to be on the show.
You know, that's a matter of opinion. I think you actually could have been Elvis in an earlier day. So many places to start, but I think I want to begin with sort of the later part of the week, all the blow-ups over the Michael Cohen recording with President Trump and all of that. I want to have you put your lawyer hat on for a little bit, so much to talk about, but let me start with that. Because the whole idea that this tape got released. I know New York is a one-party consent state. You know, it exists legally and all of that. Talk to me about the legal strategy of having Lonnie Davis, who represents Michael Cohen, release it. Is that actually a call to the White House saying, look what I got?
I think it is. I mean, I think this is a very important thing that has just happened. We have all assumed that Michael Cohen was going to be a lapdog. I mean, he has said repeatedly throughout that, you know, he was going to defend the president, you know, come hell or high water. And then, you know, slowly we see this change in his attitude where he's starting to say things like, my family comes first, my children come first, as they should. And now we see what I think is a shot across the bow. I mean, look, legally, New York State, as you say, is a, sole consent state. You know, only one person needs to consent.
And that was Michael Cohen.
Record something. And that was Michael Cohen. For example, I'm assuming you're taping me. Now, you never asked me if you could, but this is legal because I'm in New York and you're taping me, and that's fine.
We're not actually taping this. You're just talking.
Gotcha. Okay. So we're just
having a conversation. The fact that it might get recorded somewhere and played, hey, I have nothing to do with that.
Of course not. Of course not. And I'm sure Michael Cohen would say the same thing.
Right.
So the fact that it's being released, I think, is a way for, look, the president keeps signaling to people, to Manafort and to others, what he's thinking. Don't worry, guys, I'm going to pardon you someday. You know, things are going to be okay. I think that Lonnie Davis here is signaling to the president, we have a lot of stuff on you. We have things that are very, very damaging to you. And, you know, you don't.
By the way, legally,
the
legally, is it?
Yes.
I mean, you know, the whole tape has to do with, you know, paying off the paying off a Playboy model or whatever that he was allegedly dating. And the thing is, but as I'm hearing a lot of legal experts on the air, I don't really want to get too far into this, but it's sort of like, hey, no crime committed, no payoff ever made. I mean, is this, and by the way, tell me what Trump supporter out there is going to say, oh my, I can't believe that he, you know, I'm stunned, he lied about this, and oh my goodness, he had an affair with this woman, and so they don't care about any of this.
No, they clearly don't care about that. It's a whole other subject. But let's talk about the legality of it. I've listened to the tapes a number of times and a number of the recordings. First of all, I find it rather difficult to understand exactly what they're talking about. It's obvious that Cohen's talking about hush money and a payment and all that. It's not illegal. You can do that. You know, you can settle matters this way and have non-disclosures. There's not an issue with that. The illegality of this whole thing actually turns out to be a campaign finance issue, where you know, David Pecker and the National Enquirer are being used to support the campaign, where money is being used from Trump's companies, a corporate entity, to help his campaign. There are a lot of disclosure things that should have happened here. So it seems clear to me, as someone who has practiced election law, both federal and state, that there are a number of election law violations that have gone on that need to be investigated.
And who's in trouble, Cohen or Trump?
Oh, the campaign. I mean, it would definitely be the Trump campaign. It would definitely be the president for authorizing this, for allowing this to happen, and for them not to report it in any way, shape, or form. I mean, that's who truly will end up being in trouble for this if it happens. I mean, I was just going to say, the Federal Election Commission is not going to be overly concerned, I think, with Michael Cohen. They will be concerned with the Republican nominee clearly bypassing the election laws, accepting in-kind contributions, using money from his corporate account to pay off things to help his political well-being. They'll be concerned about that.
And there'll be a fine or something like that, whatever. But I mean, I guess what I'm saying is, for the folks who want to take down Donald Trump and want to see him go down, this whole thing is not on that path.
No, and let's just talk about that for a minute. You know, people on my side of the aisle need to be careful how they talk about these type of things, because, you know, there's a bit of hysteria, and everything that Donald Trump does is, oh, let's impeach him, you know, let's throw him in jail, let's do whatever, which is more his language than our language. But they need to be careful. I mean, the type of thing to impeach a president of the United States obviously is murky. You know, high crimes and misdemeanors, we've never totally defined what that means. But this type of thing, I don't think so. I think there may be other things that are much more painful to him and hurtful to him than this. But as far as I see the tape at this point, you're looking at a campaign finance violation more than anything.
All right. Let me turn to Helsinki for a moment, because it's been fascinating to see that the discussion, that the press conference portion of the Helsinki meeting between Presidents Trump and Putin, there was a question asked by one of the reporters of President Putin, essentially, did you want Donald Trump to win, and did you order people to help him? And Putin went on to say, yes. And he explained why, and yes, he did. Fascinatingly, the White House releases the transcript of that press conference, and the entire question about did you want Trump to win was removed. We heard it because we saw it live, and it's in other places, but the official White House website removes it. Something doesn't seem fair about that.
Well, fair. Yes, it is worse than not being fair. It is horrible. I actually went back and read the transcript, because, you know, I saw it live and I heard it, and then I heard what the White House said, and I thought, gee, maybe I had dreamt it. So I did read it, and they did ask specifically, did you want President Trump to win the election? And the second part was, did you direct any of your officials to help him do that? Well, Putin only answered the first part, saying, yes, I wanted him to win, you know, because he thought it'd be good for Russia and American relations. He never answered the second part. But the more important thing here is, the White House is whitewashing the news. The White House is, you know, look, all White Houses like to put their own spin on things, obviously. We all understand that. But to cut out and make it seem like it never happened and to try to change history is something we have never seen before. This president, this White House, this administration is doing things we have never seen before in trying to control what the American people know about what is going on about them. It is horrible. It is abhorrent. You know, I'm sure they're going to ask Sarah Sanders about it over and over again, and she'll just say, oh, well, that was the transcript. And for a lot of Americans, that will be sufficient. But, you know, you saw it. I saw it. Many of your listeners, I'm sure, have heard it or seen it. This is not uncommon. They are trying to change what is going on in history and what is happening and trying to change the official record that historians will look back on. This is one thing they have done. There are many other instances, much lower profile than this. But this is the type of thing that the American people should be, whoever you support for president of the United States, should be greatly concerned about. This is un-American. This is a horrible thing they did.
Yeah, I mean, if Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama had done this, certainly the other side would be screaming about it. So this is really not, shouldn't
be a partisan
issue.
Well, they'd be screaming, lock them up, as you know.
Well, true.
Seems to be their favorite phrase.
In a related issue, the president tweets the other day, you know, hey, Putin doesn't want Trump. He literally doesn't want Trump. They're out to help the Democrats. So in a variety of ways, the president has lately acknowledged that there is hacking, except when he says that there isn't. But anyway, if there is hacking, well, they're out there to help the Democrats because nobody's tougher on Russia than me. I imagine that is a phrase, once again, directly directed to his supporters.
Yeah, I think so. I also think he's trying, again, to change history. Look, he is so, let's use the word, paranoid that people are going to think that he didn't really win the 2016 election. Now, nobody is really saying that. No Democrats are saying that. But he is so afraid that he will look illegitimate that he has to make this whole thing up, even though the intelligence community, to the person, has said that clearly Russia hacked us. So now he's trying to say that the Russians are hacking the 2018 midterm elections in order to help the Democrats. Well, he's doing that for a couple of reasons. One, it's trying to get attention off of him onto the Democrats. And two, he's already building the case for why he's going to lose the House of Representatives. All the polls are showing, everything we're seeing is showing that the Democrats may pick up 30 seats, if not more. Well, they only need 23. So Trump is already starting here in, you know, mid to late July, laying the base for I'm going to lose, and he's already blaming it on someone. So now he's spreading it out. So instead of it, all the attention being on him, once the Democrats win in November, they win the House, now he's got a ready straw man to point to the Russians and say, you see, the problem here is nobody in the intelligence community thinks that is actually happening. So once again, he is on the wrong side of his own intelligence community. In 2016, it happened. He said it didn't. In 2018, we have no proof yet that it is happening. He says it is.
You know, it's interesting, too, the effort now of the administration to remove security clearance for people like James Comey, who doesn't have it anyway, and Andrew McCabe, who doesn't have it anyway, and Clapper and Rice and others who do currently have it. The theory being they've been critical of the administration, so they're out of the picture. And as Sarah Sanders said, they're monetizing it. We're going to talk about the concept of monetizing in just a moment. But what's the point of having people in prior administrations have a security clearance going forward? Is it about letting them write books for the future and let them speak out against the president?
No, look, it's really important. There's a couple of things going on here. Those people, and I've known a number of them over the years, people who are in high levels of authority at the CIA and other agencies, when they leave, they are the institutional knowledge. They're the people who know what happened, you know, 4-8 years ago. They are a invaluable resource for the current administration to reach back and to ask them, well, how did you deal with this? You know, what happened when you were dealing with Syria? How did this work out? And you realize that since you and I and the rest of the country, we don't know what happened, you know, behind the scenes because it's classified. There are very few people who do. Now, if you cut them off from what's happening today, You can't call them anymore. So, I mean, how would it work? You call someone up and you say, hey, look, let me just explain what's going on. Well, first of all, I can't tell you that because it's classified. So you and I cannot have a conversation. So this is the, you know, cutting off your nose to spite your face type of thing. This is just petty and small and stupid because you are hurting the very people that Donald Trump has appointed to these jobs to do their job because they no longer can do it as well as they can because they have lost this tremendous pool of people who have great resources and great knowledge to share with them. So it's really a small and petty thing he's doing. And again, it's to stifle opposition. This is something this administration has done masterfully, you know, lying about what's going on, changing the facts, changing the news, stopping people who oppose them. I mean, if you and I were talking about a different country, I think this language would make sense. But we're talking about the United States. We're not used to this. And, you know, it seems, as you alluded to before, there hasn't been a tremendous uproar from the general public either. But, you know, there are a lot of people who realize what's going on. What they're doing by cutting these people off is a terrible mistake.
It's actually national security assistance that is needed for in this country. So Sarah Sanders also kind of snuck in her comment there, you know, and by the way, these folks are monetizing. They're making money off the government. And that, of course, is inappropriate. After all, this has been Made in America Week. So I imagine if you are President Trump or Ivanka Trump, the last thing you want is to talk about products that aren't made in America, right?
Well, surely. You mean sort of all of hers. You know, Ivanka Trump has a entire clothing line that seems to be made, you know, any place but America and under what conditions we hardly know. And, you know, it was nice to see that this week she finally decided that she wanted to do her job working in the White House as opposed to running a clothing line. So she's giving up her clothing line. You know, my point on that is, one, it's about time. This should have been done during the transition. In between Election Day and Inauguration Day, she, her husband, the president, all should have given up their businesses. You don't go into office to make money. That's not what this is about. You go into public life to do good for other people, not to do well for yourself. And I think, you know, with what happened in Canada with the Hudson Company kicking her line out, with other companies in the United States, with them losing money, I think it just became embarrassing. And so I think they came up with this nice rosy story about, you know, she really wants to concentrate on being an advisor to the president, and this is distracting to her having this business as a way of doing it. But look, she was making a ton of money because the Chinese government was giving her special dispensation and allowing her goods to be sold in China when others weren't. So she was taking it to the bank for quite some time, and now I think she just got religion on it, and she probably got religion on it because the sales are way down.
So the president maintains his popularity rating. I'm just curious, sort of last topic as we wrap up, and I say that because this could be a very long topic. We'll do it some other time. But the existence of the tariffs, and we're now having farmers and other industries not happy about the farmers. And, of course, the president says we'll give them a $12 billion bailout, take care of our farmers. Of course, you and I are going to pay the bill on that one. But we're gonna fix it that way, at least in the short term. The president says, hang on, be patient. You know, we're going to win this thing in the end. I guess my question is, now that potentially a negative economic impact is hitting key Trump supporters, as far as I can see, manufacturers and farmers and those kinds of things. Is that where the president might pay a price for his base? Or do we see what I have seen anecdotally, which is a lot of them saying, all right, I'm suffering, but I'm going to stick with him. He knows what he's doing.
You know, it's interesting. I've seen those same anecdotal things, and I kind of think it may be the way it is. Look, this is a
what will be the
payoff.
Just hang in there?
Yeah, I think a lot of them will just hang in there. 88% in the latest polls, 88% of Republican voters are still with him.
That's right.
I'm stunned. I mean, that is just amazing to me. This could have been a major issue for Democrats in Iowa and Kansas and, you know, in some of the congressional races. It could have saved us, you know, a Senate seat here or there, maybe the North Dakota seat. It is a brilliant political move. It is totally counter to their, you know, cut the deficit and you know, save money and do those type of things. Like, I think they're where they're doing that is in the environment and other areas. So it is a total sop to, you know, his political base. But it's a brilliant move politically on his part. I haven't seen anything. Now, granted, it just happened, but I haven't seen anything that has made me believe that those people are going to run away from him. In fact, everything I have seen so far, and we'll see polling in the next week or so, but everything I've seen so far is it's not going to budge anybody.
It's very stunning, and I think I can't wait to see the history books get written 10 and 20 years from now as we look back and try and understand what is clearly a phenomenon in this country we've never seen before. I do have a guess, which is I think part of what's supporting this is the fact that is that social media and Fox News and all that provides the avenue by which people who support the president and want to support the president can get their thoughts confirmed and affirmed day mm-hmm. after day and all day long by just exposing themselves to all that. I'm not judging it. I'm just saying by way of explanation, I think in the future that is what we're going to see is happening. That's what's changed in this world, is that all the technology and the clearly divisive networks, MSNBC for the liberals and Fox for the conservatives, but the fact that people can just immerse themselves in their own world, never have to tip their head out of the water at anything else, and it makes it easy to just say, I'm not budging my position.
And I think you're right, and I think that's a very good point. But also, when the person that you believe in this case the president, comes back after a horrendous job in Helsinki, you know, totally selling out American interests, comes back and says, ah, I misspoke. I said would. I meant wouldn't. It's a mistake. You know, why wouldn't Russia want to do this? You know, I really support the he has it every way on every issue. And so for his people, they're only hearing what they want to hear. And since he's able himself, not even through Fox or other things, but he himself is able to communicate directly to the public and tell them, this is what I meant, this is what I'm doing, this is why this is good for you. He is controlling the dialogue, and he is making the news and the history the way he wants it to appear to those people. That is extraordinarily dangerous.
And it's why we'll keep talking about it and analyzing it and trying to key it, be as balanced as we can as time goes on. It's important, I think, for our democracy and for any future leaders, because this may be the first time we witness something like this. Probably won't be the last. Richard Gordon, political strategist, Democratic political strategist. I say that because if there's any future candidates listening to this, and they do, they might want to call you and get some advice, and also a great analyst of all that's going on politically. Thank you, my friend, and legally, by the way, today. Thanks for wearing your lawyer's hat as well. I sure appreciate your time.
Always a pleasure being with you. Thank you so much.
All right. That'll wrap the podcast up for this week. Tune in next week. More good stuff to come.